very few people in this world get killed by a stranger.
It was a marriage of pure hatred. And they were doing all they could to hurt each other.
We got the comment that one of them's going to kill the other one.
I opened the body bag. Fairly obviously, this is a human leg.
Despite the fact that there was a lot of suspicion, there wasn't a lot of evidence.
Nobody saw anything.
Every murder is a mystery. But a victim's body is a sea of evidence. Every fiber is a clue. Every wound, a piece of the puzzle. The medical examiner holds the key to unlock their stories and catch a killer. This is Secrets of the Morgue.
Toronto thinks of itself as being Toronto the Good. Kind of a safe place where you can walk on the street at night and everything is fine. It actually isn't that way at all. A lot of violent crime happens here.
When you leave Toronto, the Burlington Bridge connects Toronto and the GTA to the Niagara region, right over the western tip of Lake Ontario. It is a very, very busy bridge.
I think it's about close to 200 feet from the road surface down to the water.
The bridge is a landmark for the Toronto area. And one day in January, children walking below it discover the unthinkable.
In the afternoon, right around the rush hour, I received a call that a portion of a leg had washed ashore.
Mark Mendelson is one of the first detectives to inspect the grisly remains.
It was a fair size, and it was the type of situation where you could look at it and know that this was not a disarticulation of the body part through natural process in the water, that this leg had been removed. There is nothing more important for a homicide investigator to see the body in two locations. One is what we often refer to as in situ. In other words, seeing the body where it is. The second place that an investigator needs to go is to the autopsy.
Dr. David King, a forensic pathologist who's performed over 9,000 autopsies, is assigned to the case.
Every case is a mystery to some degree or other. And I never quite know what I'm going to find. It's an important part of forensic pathology to answer questions and to get to the truth of what caused the death. And we have a duty to the deceased. I open the body bag, and fairly obviously, this is a human leg, apparently divided at the mid-thigh.
To start, Dr. King needs to determine if he's dealing with an accident, a suicide, or a homicide.
The information I had at that point was that this was most probably a suicide death.
There was a man who had committed suicide in that area, had been seen to jump off the bridge, but his body had not been located.
I'd seen a number of cases where people had jumped off that Skyway Bridge into the canal. A drop from that height would probably be fatal.
After hitting the water, police speculate that the suicide victim then lost a leg in a gruesome way.
A freighter had gone through the ship canal, and therefore the leg could have been severed by the ship's propeller.
Dr. King examines the leg bone for clues to determine how it was cut off.
I looked at the femur where the bone had been separated, and the first thing I noticed was visible saw marks on the severed end.
When you think about sawing somebody's leg off, you know that you're using some sort of blade where you have control and the cut is straight. When people have had a limb cut off by way of a propeller, it's not a clean cut, it's a ripping cut, it's a shearing cut, almost akin to being bitten by a shark.
If this leg had been severed by the ship's propeller, there wouldn't have been saw marks on the end of the bone. I called the coroner and told him that this was a very suspicious case, probably a homicide.
News of the leg travels fast. Several detectives working on missing person cases show up at the morgue.
There was this mad dash of all investigators that had body parts missing to view this leg and see whether it in fact matched the victim I was looking for or somebody else's.
Families with missing loved ones are desperate for answers and praying for closure one way or another.
At this stage, I want to provide the police with as much information as I can to help them in identifying the person who's lost the leg.
With just a leg to analyze, Dr. King looks for any indication of the victim's identity.
There are several things I noticed about the leg. It's a large leg, a long leg. It's the leg of a white person. The severed end of the leg, the thigh, there is rather more fatty tissue than muscular tissue. From my experience, women have considerably more subcutaneous fat in relation to muscle, particularly in their legs and in their thighs. And this tends to point towards this being a woman's leg.
Detectives attending the autopsy have their first clue.
You need something to go on. You need some direction. And just by identifying the gender, you have something to work with.
The next step in identification is to determine how long the victim has been in the water.
As an investigator, you have to have a time frame to work with.
This leg was found at the beginning of January. It's been in a very cold environment, so that would tend to preserve the leg for longer than, say, if it's recovered from water in the summer. So it's going to be more difficult to give an estimate when death occurred. My examination shows that, in fact, there is only very minimal evidence of decomposition. So I give the police a very rough estimate that the leg hadn't been in the water all that long, but probably a month.
The forensic timeline connects the leg to Detective Tony Warr's case. A middle-aged woman who disappeared a month ago.
I had been assigned to investigate the missing person, Nicole Madison, who had disappeared on December the 2nd. And then on January the 6th, a few days after we started, it came to my attention that there had been a human leg located. I started with the Toronto Police Homicide Squad in 1980. I just always aspired to be a homicide detective. It's a bigger challenge than any other investigation because your victim is unable to communicate to you. In all other crimes, the victim can tell you what happened. So the circumstances of how the person met their death are a mystery until you figure out from the clues at the scene.
Dr. King continues his autopsy on the leg, revealing even more similarities to Detective Warr's missing person.
By looking at the epiphyses, these are the ends of the bones at the joints, to see whether they're completely fused with the shafts of the bones, because up until about the age of 20, the early 20s, you can still see some separation of the epiphyses. And in this case, they were well fused, so this appeared to be an older adult.
The forensic clues all suggest that Nicole Madison could be the victim.
Nicole was 52 years old. She was a fairly large woman. She was 5'10". Not overweight, but a heavily built woman.
She was a mother. She was a homemaker and a grandmother. She looked after her grandchildren. She was a corrections officer, so I think she was multifaceted, but overall I would say pretty strong, pretty tough.
It's very difficult to look at a missing persons case and say, this person has been a victim of foul play. So this was why I had to keep reminding myself not to get tunnel vision, that there was still a lot to do and quite possibly she could show up any day now. I don't know how to describe the feeling, but I thought that that was her leg. But I needed to prove it.
But the investigation into Nicole's disappearance has a twist.
Her husband is David Madison. He's a police sergeant at 52 Division in Toronto.
Investigating a police officer, whether you work with them or whether you work for the same police service as them or whether they work in a different service, is very difficult. And the reason is that police officers are kept to a higher standard. They are in a position of authority. They are in a position of trust. And even though these expectations are placed upon you, they're not superhuman individuals. And they have frailties, and they have problems. It's a difficult concept to wrap your head around, but it happens.
Police investigating police would make it a very different investigation.
Toronto police are investigating the disappearance of Nicole Madison. Detective Tony Waugh's first person of interest is her husband, Sergeant David Madison, a fellow police officer.
David said they met in France when he was with the military, and they've been married in France and been married for about 30 years. He said they had a rocky marriage. They fought often and they argued a lot.
Nicole was trying her best to keep her life together under very, very trying circumstances. The marriage had completely kind of deteriorated, and they were living very separate lives.
Nicole had moved into a house in Fonthill, a small town near Niagara Falls, leaving David the family home in Toronto, 80 miles away.
Moving into the house was a fresh start for her. And for her to have a house of her own, I would say, was a fortress for her.
Detective Waugh asks Madison, when was the last time he saw his wife?
That was December the 2nd. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He said he was driving with his wife in the area of Spadina and King when they had been arguing all day. And when they got to the intersection of King Street, which is a very busy downtown intersection, lots of pedestrian traffic, lots of car and bus traffic, they were stopped, and she got out of the car and smashed the window of the car on the passenger side and walked away. And that was the last time he saw her. One of the questions being raised right at the time was, why did he wait 19 days to report his wife missing? He believed that she would be somewhere, either staying with a friend and would show up at home in a few days.
David Madison is surprisingly blunt about the argument with his wife that led to her disappearance.
He's very calm. He's a policeman talking to other policemen and just telling us the story about his wife going missing. David was pretty open as to the fact that it was a rocky marriage. He did not hide the fact that he had a girlfriend.
Who knows what actually goes on in a marriage? David made no secret of the fact he was having an affair. In fact, he tortured Nicole with that knowledge. It was a marriage of pure hatred. And they were doing all they could to hurt each other. The affair was a good weapon.
Detective Warr asks Madison if there's any reason Nicole could be in danger, and gets a disturbing answer.
He was saying he believed that she'd gone down to Niagara Falls and jumped in. He said that if she ever did commit suicide, that's how she would do it.
Madison is brutally honest about his wife and marriage. But detectives need to corroborate Nicole's state of mind.
You try and build a picture, so you start by talking with friends, with family, and see if there's any legitimate reason why this person may be missing. Was it financial? Was it mental health issues? Had this ever happened before? Had she gone missing before? Did she leave to go be with somebody else? All of these questions have to be answered.
I spoke to friends of hers, and she had told one friend that she had taken, I think it was $5,000 out of an account and was keeping it so that if she ever had to leave home, she'd have some money to exist on.
Her actions were to try and get out of the marriage. So, you know, she was talking to friends, she was showing friends, like, here's where my money is. I'm going to leave a letter with you in case anything happens. The two of them were in a very violent relationship, and neither of them was giving an inch. I think she felt more threatened than threatening, but backed into a corner, who knows what she might have done.
It's been 40 days since Nicole Madison jumped out of her car in downtown Toronto and vanished.
There was no sightings of her. She made no contact with any of her friends. She had completely disappeared.
People disappear for a variety of reasons. They either disappear because they're the victim of foul play, or they disappear because they have made an effort, a conscious effort, to not be found. And if you're dealing with a missing woman who has vaporized off the face of the earth, then that has to be a very large flag and a very large clue that foul play is probably suspected.
Detective Warr analyzes Nicole's medical records. He wants Dr. King to confirm if her blood type matches the leg that was recovered.
Another way we can help determine the identity of the deceased is to collect blood tissue and other tissues, in fact, and determine the blood type.
If you knew, you know, that your victim was O positive, and you could find out through biology testing that the victim was O negative, you could rule that person out immediately as being your victim.
In this case, there really wasn't blood present in the leg, so it was going to be touch and go whether blood grouping could be done.
But 35 years of forensic experience helps Dr. King find a microscopic amount of blood evidence in the severed leg.
It was the same blood type. We knew the leg could still be hers. Our biggest challenge now was to definitively prove that it was Nicole.
Detectives reach out to Nicole's family in France for any information on her whereabouts or what could have happened to her.
I sent an officer over there who was fluent in French to speak to them, and obviously they were distraught and upset.
Nicole's family has no idea she was missing or where she could be, but detectives tell them they can still help find her.
DNA today is so much more accurate and acute than it was then. It was still a pretty new science then.
Police believe this new leading-edge science could identify their victim.
We did not have Nicole, because all we had was the leg, so we could not compare it to her. So we had to recreate her DNA by getting samples of her parents, her siblings, to be able to do a cross-match to say, yes, that's the same DNA that's in the leg.
But in 1992, DNA tests take months. While they wait for samples from Nicole's family overseas, detectives return to Lake Ontario, where the severed leg was found.
What we decided to do was to search the ship canal for remaining body parts. We used divers in the canal to search for debris or anything that might contain pieces of the body.
When you're searching a harbor or a lake with police divers and police boats, it can only be described as organized confusion. They are feeling around in the dark, because the divers themselves can only see 5, 6, 7 inches in front of them. You have old trees and bicycles and shopping carts and garbage and dead animals and everything you can possibly think of in that water. You don't know what you have until you pull it up. It's a time-consuming, frustrating process.
About 2 or 3 days into the search, the officers located a body. And maybe we've discovered the remains of Nicole. This was what we needed to cement the case.
Detectives searching for Nicole Madison find new human remains in Lake Ontario, close to where a woman's severed leg was recovered.
Once it's pulled out, we see that it's a male and it was complete. It had 2 full legs.
This turned out to be the man who was seen to jump into the canal a month earlier.
It's a disappointing result, but Dr. King has an idea. Because there were eyewitnesses who saw the man jump, they know exactly how long his body was in the icy lake. Now he can compare the condition of that body to the severed leg and determine a more accurate time of death for their Jane Doe.
I cut into the skin and subcutaneous tissues of the thigh to see how they compared to the subcutaneous tissues and thigh of the leg. Subcutaneous tissues are the tissues under the skin, between the skin and the muscle. The visual absence of decomposition of the man who had jumped was very similar to the absence of decomposition in the leg.
Dr. King believes the woman's leg was in the water for a month, which matches the date Nicole Madison disappeared.
If he had said it's been in there for 2 years, it would have kind of ruled it out and we would have maybe not been as interested in it. But when he said, you know, a month, which is, we were almost exactly a month from the day she went missing, it was very, very intriguing.
Detectives return to the location where Nicole supposedly went missing, the busy street corner where she argued with her husband, David.
We tried to verify the story of her getting out of the car. Because a woman getting out of the car and smashing a car window, somebody probably would have noticed that. So we set up a command post and we assigned officers to talk to everybody that went by, because a lot of people take the same route to work. Nobody saw anything.
Detectives are worried. One of their own is not telling the truth.
David's explanation of things didn't really add up. He was behaving really suspiciously.
It helped reinforce our belief that it didn't happen the way that David Madison had told us it would happen.
Very few people in this world get killed by a stranger. Stranger on stranger murders are rare. Most people are killed by somebody they have some association with, that they know them at some level.
Detective War doesn't plan to let anyone, especially a police officer, get away with the murder. He digs deeper into the Madisons' relationship, looking for a motive.
There was a marriage counselor that David and Nicole had seen, and we had that doctor interviewed. And we're given information about the state of the marriage. It's from that interview that we got the comment that one of them is going to kill the other one sometime. We asked our surveillance team to start building a file of his activities, where he goes and what he's doing. The motive for the surveillance is to not necessarily keep track of the person, but to learn the pattern of their behavior. I applied for and got a judicial authorization to intercept his telephone calls so that we could keep track of what he's doing and what he's telling people.
They also want to search the car Madison claims Nicole jumped out of in downtown Toronto.
According to David, the car they were driving was her car. So we obtained a search warrant to seize the car and examine the car.
The vehicle is found abandoned in a cornfield north of the city. David Madison has a curious explanation for the condition they find it in.
He was visiting his parents. Now, while there had been a fire started, which he blamed on his grandson. He said he was playing with matches and he set the car on fire. My immediate reaction was it was an attempt to destroy the car. We looked at the inside for the fire, and we found that there'd been a newspaper flyer rolled up like a wick and poked out the back between the seat and the seat back, and an attempt to start a fire in the car that didn't succeed.
It's a common misconception that you can just light something on fire and that makes the evidence disappear. People think that they can just light a match and everything is erased, and that's often not the case.
The limited damage allows detectives to uncover critical evidence.
We were examining the trunk of the car, and we found blood. The blood spattering was not visible with the naked eye. They had to basically look at it with a magnifying glass. So then we started to examine it further, and we were able to find some blonde hair. I was reasonably convinced that Nicole had been murdered and that she had probably been transported at some time after she was dead in the trunk of that car. But the challenge now was to prove that.
Detectives know blood spatter alone won't catch the killer. They need more direct physical evidence. Investigators turn to Dr. King. If he can identify the saw used to sever the leg, it would give them another key piece of evidence to search for.
One of the more important examinations that we carry out is to remove the cut end of the femur. This is the part of the bone that has the saw marks on it, because we want to carry out a much more detailed examination of these saw marks to try and determine what kind of saw was used.
Every saw is different. The striation marks that a saw leaves on skin or on bone is unique. It's like a signature. You can tell if it's an electric saw. You can tell if it's a hand saw. You can tell if it's an axe. They are very, very, very powerful pieces of evidence if you can match that saw to those marks.
I confirmed that there were what appeared to be saw marks on the bone. In addition, traces of paint, blue paint, on the cut end of the bone. This suggests to me that the paint came off the saw. And I knew from buying various tools that very often the blades are painted in one color or another. I concluded that it was probably a hacksaw.
It's a break for detectives. Now, if they can locate the actual saw, they'll have a direct link to Nicole Madison's killer.
We need to find a hacksaw.
Toronto police suspect David Madison killed his wife, Nicole, and then dismembered her with a hacksaw. They search his home looking for evidence of the crime.
We needed to identify the scene of the dismemberment. If our theory was correct, somewhere he cut up his wife's body. So we needed to find out where that happened.
Despite the fact that there was a lot of suspicion, there wasn't a lot of evidence. It was a very circumstantial case, and that made it difficult.
You know you have a murder, but you don't have a body. That's a frustrating place for an investigator to be.
If we found a saw in that location, we could have that saw examined for traces of blood or bone.
Detectives search David's house and garage for hours, but there's no sign of the hacksaw that matches the cuts on the leg. Then they uncover another compelling clue.
When we made our search on the inside of the garage door, we found a blood spatter. It wasn't a complete pattern, so it obviously had been wiped. I would suspect if you're cutting a body with a saw and a knife that there would be quite a bit of spatter.
It's not the definitive link they hoped for, but blood in the car and now David's garage is more persuasive evidence that Nicole is dead. Detectives quickly get a warrant and dispatch a forensics team to her house.
The search we conducted at Nicole's house in Font Hill took more than a week because we were not only searching for forensic evidence, we were searching for any kind of evidence that we could use in furthering our case. In the garage, in the back wall, we found some blood spattering there as well. I was speculating that the car would have been backed into the garage, the trunk opened, and then the body carried and put in the trunk. And it would cause some kind of blood spattering because there was bleeding.
Detectives want to compare the blood from both Madison homes and the burned-out car with the severed woman's leg.
I think if police find some blood in an area that they think could be a crime scene, there's a presumption that it's the answer. And it's not necessarily going to be the answer. They might not even be able to use it. It can be potentially very hard to match that blood up to anything meaningful, find out who it's from, and it might not even be relevant to the case.
With almost no blood in the leg, investigators must look for another source of DNA to test.
The first sampling didn't give us enough material because there was very little blood in the leg. So they had to sample the bone to try and derive DNA from that.
I took samples of bone marrow. Bone's good for determining DNA because particularly when there's some degree of decomposition present, it still contains the material in the bone cells that are necessary to determine DNA.
Forensic scientists were able to match the DNA of those blood spots with the leg.
Blood from the homes, car, and leg all comes from the same person. But as likely as it is Nicole's, without DNA from her family, they still can't prove it's hers.
You're waiting for the body to talk to you. You're trying to learn what you can from that piece of the body that you have. As an investigator, it is extremely frustrating when you're being so painstakingly careful to try and cover off every base, but you're running out of clues, you're running out of ideas, and you're running out of people to talk to.
Then, another body part washes up on the shore of Lake Ontario.
This is a left arm from a white person. It appeared to me probably female. There was slightly more, a little more advanced decomposition changes. When I started to dissect the arm, I noticed early changes of adipocere in some of the tissues beneath the skin of the left hand, which had not been present in the leg.
Adipocere is a change that occurs after death under certain conditions. It's a process that takes time to develop and occurs when it's cold and damp, and it causes the tissues in the body to have a waxy appearance. A body that has adipocere tells you that they had been dead for quite some time.
The formation of adipocere in the arm, but not the leg, functions as a forensic timestamp.
And this suggested to me that the arm had been put in the water at about the same time as the leg.
The closer Dr. King looks, the more similarities he finds between the arm and the leg.
One of the first things I notice is that there are saw marks on the cut end of the humerus, the bone of the upper arm, and I saw traces of blue paint. This was confirmation that this arm probably came from the same victim as the leg.
Dr. King now has another piece of a horrific puzzle, but it's not his most disturbing find.
The tips of all the fingers of the left hand have been cut off. This is obviously highly suspicious and should suggest that they have been removed to make identification much more difficult.
When you cut the fingertips off a victim, you think that you're going to get away with it. This is a killer who believes that they're able to cover their tracks.
Evidence suggests police officer David Madison killed and dismembered his wife, Nicole. But detectives still can't prove she's actually dead.
The fact that there was no body made it a difficult murder case. And the fact that science didn't help police then, as it would help them today, made it a difficult case.
We didn't know that leg was Nicole's. We were very suspicious, but we hadn't proved it scientifically yet.
Investigators hope that DNA from Nicole's immediate family in Europe will finally solve the mystery.
It took us 1 or 2 months before we could actually get the samples from France.
The DNA studies that were carried out on the samples that I took from the left leg, by comparing the DNA from the leg with relatives of the deceased in France, enabled police to confirm the leg belonged to Nicole Madison.
We had the DNA, and the chances of this being other than Nicole Madison's leg is like 2 billion to 1. We now have a body, and we have what we believe to have been a murder. So we had enough grounds to then arrest him.
On March 26th, 1992, detectives charged Sergeant David Madison with the murder of his wife, Nicole.
He was at his girlfriend's house, so we went over there and arrested him when he came out of the house. He appeared to be expecting us. It was not a shock.
In custody, Madison stuns police by confessing to the crime.
A confession is always surprising. It doesn't happen a whole lot. I think that things were unraveling for him, and there wasn't really a lot of room for him to maneuver anymore. And I think that guilt was preying on his mind.
As part of his confession, David explains how and why he killed Nicole.
On the morning of December 2nd, they were arguing at their house in Fonthill. It was a fairly heated argument. He said that she came at him with a knife and that his service revolver was nearby. He reached out for it and shot her in the chest, and that she died from that. David took the body to the car and put her in the trunk of the car and then drove to his house. And that's where he dismembered her. He put plastic around in the garage to catch most of the blood spattering. That's why we didn't find much. And then he took the body parts in separate plastic bags and drove to the Burlington Ship Canal and dropped them over the side into the canal.
Madison even reveals the lengths he went to cover up his crime.
When we searched the Fonthill house, we didn't find any bullet holes because, as we found out later, he'd re-drywalled where it occurred, so there was no trace of a gun being fired. He also admitted that it wasn't his grandson that set the fire in the car, that was him, in an attempt to destroy evidence.
By confessing, Madison avoids a trial. but not a conviction.
We charged him with first-degree murder. It was our assumption that time that he'd planned to kill his wife, and that's why he disposed of the body in the manner he did. But we had no way of disproving his story that he was defending himself from a knife attack.
The indications were she was violent as well. There's reports that she did run at him with knives and things like that. Would she actually kill him? Who knows?
David Madison pleads guilty to manslaughter and is sentenced to 10 years in prison.
I think in the back of her mind, she thought that something might happen. And I think at the same time, she didn't really think it would. Like it seems kind of incredible that the man you married could actually do you harm. I think that justice was served and he did pay a price.
Dr. King was enormous help in this case to get his expertise on what may have happened, when it may have happened, and how it could have happened. What led to it being identified as Nicole Madison's leg.
There's general satisfaction in doing my job to the best of my ability. I'm performing a public duty. That is satisfying. We speak to the dead to protect the living.
I don't think there's a better tandem than a good homicide detective and a good forensic pathologist.
There was no smoking gun, as they say. There was no eyewitness. It was a matter of the painstaking work of the forensic scientists of putting it together and proving our case for us. Without the forensic work, this case would never have been made.